Rapid expansion?
We're ready.
Worker shortage?
We're good.
Anything can change the world of work.
A celebrity buys the company.
Depends on who it is. But relax, we've got ADP.
From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court issues a major decision on climate change and regulation on what has been the most significant Supreme Court term in decades. Plus, President Biden spent the week focusing on foreign policy at the G7 and NATO summits. What did he and the other Western leaders accomplish? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot here with our Potomac Watch podcast, and I'm here with Kim Strassel and Adam O'Neill. Welcome to you both. Let's start on the home front with the Supreme Court and the decision Thursday, major one on regulation and the separation of power. Sounds arcane, not certainly as politically significant in terms of its public resonance as the abortion and gun rulings, but in its way, just as significant for how the American government can function and who has responsibility for making decisions in that government. Kim, it's a long opinion and an important dissent, but talk a little bit about what happened here in EPA versus West Virginia, in which Supreme Court ruled, six justices, 6-3, that the agency lacks the authority to regulate carbon emissions from power plants without a clear direction from Congress.
Sure. And I'm actually super excited about this. Not to bore everyone with anything too technical, but just to understand what was going on here. The Clean Air Act, obviously the EPA has the ability to require producers of electricity, for instance, coal plants or natural gas plants, to hit certain emissions targets to try to clean up the air from pollutants. And all the way up until 2015, it had always been understood that the EPA's authority was largely to require those plants to adopt new or better technology that would allow them to function more cleanly. And then in 2015, the Obama administration came up with this thing called the Clean Power Plan, in which it put out a whole new radical reading of what its authority gave it the power to do, claiming that it could, in fact, require entire plants to shift to new ways of generation. So you would have to hit a target. And if you were a coal plant, that would mean that the only way you could do it was, in fact, to instead invest in natural gas, become a natural gas plant or a renewable plant, solar or wind power. So essentially saying that they didn't just have the authority to make changes at plants, but they had the authority to change the entire mix of electricity production. That's what was in front of the court, put as simply as I can put it. And the court essentially, in an opinion put out by John Roberts, joined by the other five conservatives on the court, said, no, we have this thing called the major questions doctrine. It requires that when you're going to do things of huge economic or political consequence, that you have to have some evidence that there was clear congressional authorization for this to happen. This did not happen in the case of this EPA decision. We can go through some of the reasons why it found that. But overall, Paul, what it means is that if you have all these bureaucrats, they want to impose these major problems that Congress has nonetheless never given them authorization to do, there is now going to be a Supreme Court looking at it and brushing them back. That's a really good sign for those separation of powers, because we want Congress to be making those big decisions, not a bunch of people who are unelected and that you can't fire in the bureaucracy.
And this wasn't a decision about climate per se, in the sense that the Supreme Court wasn't issuing a policy judgment. It was just saying who gets to make that decision under the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Laws, and that lies with Congress. And that when the executive branch wants to take it upon itself to make these major decisions involving hundreds of billions of dollars of consequences, then Congress has to be the body that told them to do it. They can't just decide, well, here's a statute that, well, we haven't interpreted it this way ever before, but now we do, and we're going to issue this rule. And of course, climate policy has been fraught in Congress. They've never been able to pass what the main climate regulators want them to pass, because there's just not enough support in Congress. Joe Manchin, of course, has been an obstacle, the West Virginia senator this term, to much that the Biden administration wants to do. So the Biden administration has wanted to do it through regulation. And here's the court saying, no, you are going to have to pass it through Congress first. Now, it doesn't mean there won't be more litigation about climate policy in other realms other than power plants. But for at least for electricity production, this is going to rein in the regulatory state. So, Kim, I just want to point out here the reaction to this from Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader in the House. He said, this mega regressive extremist Supreme Court is intent on setting America back decades, if not centuries. The Republican appointed majority of the mega court, by mega he means the Trump court, is pushing the country back to a time when robber barons and corporate elites have complete power and average citizens have no say, end quote. So he takes a moderate position there in response to that very tempered judgment.
You know, and my response to Chuck Schumer is, if you really want to give those people a voice, then do your job and pass a law. And that is essentially what the court is saying. It's quite astonishing if you think about it, Paul. Here is the leader of the United States Senate essentially complaining that the court is returning power to the United States Senate or the United States Congress overall. The problem is that they don't want to do their job, or they feel that they can't, or they're not willing to make any kind of compromises in the agenda that they are putting forward. That's always the argument from the left is, well, Congress has just become too difficult a place. It's too hard to get things through. And therefore, we need the bureaucracy to do this. In fact, the response from all kinds of Democrats today was the EPA must have this authority. It must, or people will die. Well, Congress needs to be the one that provides it if it can cobble together a majority to pass that sort of thing. And the fact that it can't is not the court's problem. This is written out in the Constitution. And if overall what this does is, and maybe we'll hopefully, I hope, get some more opinions like this that follow up on this major questions doctrine. But what we'd like to see is a new onus, as it were, on Congress to figure out that it does need to be providing guidance, especially on these issues of major questions. And that if it doesn't, the court simply isn't going to let the bureaucracy step into that vacuum.
Adam, from your vantage point out of the country, you've been watching the Supreme Court term nonetheless. What's your take on not this ruling in particular, but more broadly about what this court has done this year?
Well, I've been learning quite a bit about the American judicial system from all of the various European experts on the American judicial system that popped up after the Dobbs decision came down.
That was the abortion decision.
Right. But as an American myself and someone on the right who has followed this, to me, the big theme of this court's term seems to be what Kim was alluding to before, and that's returning a lot of issues that the court had taken on itself to the democratic process, whether that's abortion going back to state legislatures or whether it's environmental regulation in this particular instance going back to Congress. And it's incredibly encouraging. And I don't think that it's anti-democratic like a lot of the overheated rhetoric says, but in fact, it's the exact opposite.
And when you think about other cases, not just the EPA case, but also the Dobbs case, where they were turning abortion politics and policy to the states. And then you have a couple of rulings earlier on the bureaucracy, but the CDC eviction moratorium and the OSHA vaccine mandate, both of which were overturned by the court eventually, basically saying you have to have authority from Congress, Kim, to do these things. This is fundamental to American governance. Over the decades of the last century, the administrative state, the regulatory state, has accrued enormous power. And one of the great things that I see in this Supreme Court is their willingness to push back against that accretion of power and say, look, the executive and Congress, you have to stay in your lanes, as defined by the Constitution. And we judges, you know, we'll stay in our lane too.
Yeah, stay in your lanes is the excellent term for this. And a lot of people will look at this and view it as a brushback to the bureaucracy, and it certainly is. But I would just stress that it is also a little bit of a slap on the knuckles to Congress, because we have just had, and I would say maybe for the last 70 years, a Congress that has become ever more, as Senator Ben Sasse would say it, a self-neutering organization that basically we now have entitlement programs that essentially run on autopilot. And that's about two-thirds of the spending. So no one in Congress is paying any attention to that. I can't tell you the last time they actually managed to fulfill their basic requirements, one of their most fundamental jobs, which is simply passing spending bills for the different agencies and branches. It's been maybe a decade. They don't engage in any committee debate. They don't engage in any markups on the floor. Instead, what you have is this Congress, and both sides do it. The Republicans do it and the Democrats do it. The leaders go in some back office and write a bill themselves and then go out and make sure that they'll have their whole party in support, land it on the floor, and about 2 hours later require everyone to vote on it. That is the kind of vacuum that allows the bureaucrats to march in. And so, you know, in a certain way, you can't necessarily fault the executive branch for taking full advantage of the holes that they have been given to drive bulldozers through. This is why it's so important that the court said this. They said, we're not going to allow that anymore. So really, honestly, Congress, you're going to need to step up to the plate again.
Will Congress be up to it? Well, we'll find out. All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Joe Biden's trip to Europe and what he did and didn't accomplish when we come back.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here with Adam O'Neill and Kim Strassel on Potomac Watch. And Joe Biden taking a tour of European summitry here, NATO summit in Spain, preceded by the G7 summit in the Bavarian Alps in Germany. The president and the G7 leaders focused on Ukraine, obviously, buttressing NATO. Let's listen to the president talk about Vladimir Putin and the accession into NATO of Finland and Sweden.
He tried to weaken us. He expected our resolve to fracture, but he's getting exactly what he did not want. He wanted the Finlandization of NATO. He got the NATOization of Finland. Just think about this. That's what he thought. Now NATO and Sweden are closer than ever to joining, and this will occur. We're more united than ever. And with the addition of Finland and Sweden, we'll be stronger than ever. They have serious militaries, both of them.
Adam, I think President has a point about Finland and Sweden joining. That clearly is a very good step and does strengthen NATO because he's right. The Finns in particular have a pretty darn good military considering the size of the country. It was about 7 million people or so. And you were recently in Helsinki and interviewed the prime minister for a very good feature. But I guess the question I have for you, talk a little bit about that, but also, is the president right that NATO and the G7 are more united than ever?
He's absolutely right. On the first part, we could quibble about what exactly Finlandization of NATO means. I think he just didn't want NATO to grow. It sounds good, but I'm not quite sure what exactly that means. But he's right. Finland and Sweden did not want to join NATO. They were happy to be military non-aligned. I'd interviewed the president earlier this month, and I'd interviewed him a few years before that. And the change in how he saw the world was very obvious and very palpable. And that was purely because, and he made clear to me, it's purely because of Vladimir Putin. He said it publicly, you did this, this is your fault. And one way you can know that the Russians aren't happy about this is before Finland decided to join NATO, and before Sweden decided to join NATO, they were saying there will be technical measures, or they were being sort of vague, but they said there will be some kind of punishment or some kind of reaction. And just now, you're seeing different Russian officials saying, we don't care, it doesn't actually matter, because it's humiliating for them that they demanded something happen and the countries ignored them. As for the unity overall, I will say, Finland and Sweden are not in NATO yet, And I know when we spoke earlier this week, I was skeptical that this would get wrapped up by the Madrid conference. And a lot of the reporting seems to suggest that's the case. But just before we started recording this, I saw a piece of news where Mr. Erdogan, the president of Turkey, said, well, look, I could still veto their admission if they don't live up to the promises that they made me. Because Turkey had initially blocked Finland and Sweden from joining NATO, even though it had initially said it wouldn't mind. So there's still some confusion about what exactly will be acceptable to them. And I think these objections will be overcome, but we're not quite sure yet. As for the overall alliance unity, the rhetoric is great. Everyone agrees now, we want Ukraine to win, we will be with them, we will stand by them, and you're having more equipment sent to Ukraine, and it's moving in the right direction. It's a few months too late. But underneath the surface, as the war drags on, President Biden is going to have a lot of work to do to keep the alliance together, because there will be a lot of pressure from different corners of the alliance, whether you're in the east or the west or the south or north, to push for different outcomes in this war.
Well, on that point, Germany and France, of course, are the weakest links, I think, when it comes to their staying power, if you will, in support of Ukraine. The Brits and the Eastern NATO countries being the strongest, along with the United States. Interesting that NATO has announced new military deployments to the Eastern Front of NATO, new rotational deployments to Romania and the Baltic states, a new permanent headquarters in Poland, which I think is significant. Adam, and more U.S. troops in Europe. We now have about 100,000, if I'm not mistaken, and there's going to be more, although I think it's unspecified. How significant is this military rotation realignment?
It's a generational change. After the end of the Cold War, you know, when we used to have hundreds of thousands of American troops because of a fear of a possible Soviet invasion of West Germany, the U.S. wound down its presence in Europe, and the Europeans wound down their own military spending. But we're seeing promises for more military spending. And this is a trend that began years ago. This is the ninth consecutive year where the NATO allies in Europe and Canada have increased military spending. And the U.S. is sending troops to Poland, the permanent base. And the other countries, Germany, Canada, the United Kingdom, they're increasing, and we'll have to look under the hood and take a look at the details, but they're increasing their commitment to the Baltic states. France is doing more for Romania. So we can quibble about how much they're contributing. I think Spain still spends an embarrassing 1% of gross domestic product on defense. But the overall trend makes sense. And critics are right. China is a bigger threat than Russia. But Russia has shown us this year that it can still do a lot of damage, even with its backwater economy and its military that isn't as impressive as we thought. And so it's encouraging that Europe is moving in the right direction and that the U.S. is doing so as well.
Kim, the statement in rewritten strategic concept document by NATO, for the first time singling out China as a challenge to NATO's interests and values, which is, of course, interesting because NATO is a European defensive alliance and historically has not been focused on Asia. There is no equivalent to NATO in Asia. But it underscores, I think, the fact that the Europeans are seeing through China's actions in Hong Kong and elsewhere and the threat to Taiwan, that there's a degree of Western unity which is going to be required not only to defend Europe against Russia and other threats, but also the threats to Western democracies posed by China. And of course, Japan, the Japanese prime minister, was in attendance at the G7 summit. And so were, for the first time, the prime minister of South Korea, and I think of New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah, this is all overdue and all very, very welcome as well, too. I mean, we've spoken so much on this podcast and in our editorial columns about those growing threats from China. NATO's been pretty quiet on this up until now. And so that new strategic concept statement noted that Beijing threatens its interests and its security and its values, all of which is true. Now we'll see what kind of actions it takes to sort of follow up with that statement in terms of where it is deploying its own resources, putting its own focus in order to kind of turn that concept concept into something that is more a reality and gets China's attention.
All right. Excellent. Thank you both. We have a question to end here today from one of our listeners, Christine Jones, French teacher in Upper Dublin High School in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, writes, I was struck by President Biden's response to the constitutional decision on abortion. By all accounts, he was highly critical of this decision. Does a sitting president typically attack a Supreme Court decision? Also, why is it taking so long to uncover the person who leaked the draft of this decision? Kim, you want to take the first one on the president criticizing the Supreme Court?
Yes. I mean, there are often times when a Department of Justice is on the losing side. It will express regret at the way an opinion went, etc. It's less common for presidents to actually go out and smack around the court itself for a very important reason, that it's long been understood that it benefits everybody in the country when the Supreme Court is viewed as a neutral arbiter of these decisions, a referee who calls the balls and strikes, and that the appropriate response from administrations when they're on the losing end of a court case to say, you know, okay, nonetheless, the Supreme Court has spoken. When you get really aggressive and begin criticizing the court, especially in the terms that this president used, it really goes to questions of legitimacy. It undermines the legitimacy of the court. It makes it out to sound as though it's just another political organization in Washington when it really isn't, and it needs to be seen as something else. And the president has an obligation to help in that goal. So it was unfortunate to see, and it's something that we should hope that presidents don't engage in routinely.
Well, but not unheard of. Remember, President Obama criticized the Supreme Court Citizens United decision at a State of the Union address where the justices were present, and famous episode where Justice Alito shook his head no while the president was speaking.
And Trump. Let's point that out, too. Trump was not quiet about criticizing the court.
Well, that's for sure. So regarding the question about the leak of the draft Alito opinion, I think the answer to that is very hard to find a leaker. It's just typically very hard to do so, particularly without subpoena power. The way these things often happen is that the leaker doesn't call up a reporter and say, hey, Kim Strassel, I got something for you, man, and then email you the document. That just doesn't happen. You know, we're just not that lucky.
I wish. I know.
The way it works is, you know, they'll give it to a cutout, somebody, give the document to a cutout, who then gives it to a reporter. And so you have some deniability, and it's harder to track down through electronic means. Now, maybe they'll find out. The U.S. Marshal Service is still investigating, but it is not as easy as you think to track down a leaker. So I want to thank Christine Jones for writing in. I want to thank Kim and Adam, and I want to thank all of you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.